Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Humans have thought forever about aging and immortality. These days, science and gerontology look for long life and healthy life. Some still want more, super long life, verging on forever, and they swear we can have it. It may sound like a vampire movie. It's more than that. This hour on Point, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Jonathan Weiner on the history and future of aging, or not aging at all. You can join the conversation. How long would you really like to live? What looks possible to you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Jonathan Weiner. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Beak of the Finch, a celebrated science writer. His new book is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. Jonathan Weiner, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Very nice to be here.
You've got William Shakespeare right up front from Antony and Cleopatra. I have immortal longings in me. And don't we know it? I guess you write that the study of longevity is now in an almost feverish state. Feverish over what, Jonathan?
Well, back when I started out as a young science writer in the early 80s, I talked with a biologist who was trying to understand aging and getting nowhere. And she was in her 80s, and it was clear that time was running out for her. There just weren't clues. There weren't enough clues. And now there are so many clues that people who study aging are getting, as I say, feverish, a little bit almost teenage dreams of immortality in the air.
What do you say when you say immortality? I mean, I look in your book and there's numbers like 500, even 1,000 get tossed around in there. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's what some people are talking about, and you have to be careful about this because gerontology is an overheated field. The whole subject is so charged that it's hard even for level conservative biologists to stay calm and objective. And there are always people at the fringes who are talking about immortality. You know, you go all the way back to Gilgamesh 4,500 years ago, and people are dreaming of this. As soon as you start seeing writing, people are writing stories about finding cures for mortality. So the person I focus on in the book is one of these people at the edge, Aubrey David Jasper Nicholas de Grey. He's a Cambridge-trained computer scientist who became fascinated by biology when he married a biologist, an older woman, 20 years older than himself, and became obsessed with the problem of aging and curing aging. So he's the most ardent spokesman, Aubrey is, for these humongous numbers, 500 years, 1,000 years, even, he whispers sometimes, a million years.
A million years of life. We will reel this in to a little more mainstream, but give us a sense of how he's thinking. Do people think he's a total crackpot when he throws around numbers like that? And what's the basis for that kind of talk? Is it just the same as, I don't know, Ponce de Leon looking for a fountain of youth, you know?
It's really hard to say right now. And as you say, the mainstream is way, way, way more conservative. What we're looking at from mainstream gerontologists is perhaps another 7 good years of life, 7 healthy years.
That's 7 on top of the, what, roughly 80 or so age that's the average lifespan in the developed world now?
Exactly. But
that's
Aubrey
a heck of a
argues,
lot fewer than 1,000 or 500
it's
or a million.
It's a slight difference from a million. Yeah, that's right. And that is the conservative bet. I mean, Aubrey's arguments are not crackpot in the sense that he is very smart and he's very well-versed in exciting developments in the field, which everybody is excited about, genuinely exciting new research. Mm-hmm. What he argues is that we can achieve a sort of escape velocity, that all we have to do is keep living a little bit longer and a little bit longer so that the science and the medicine advance fast enough to keep pushing that edge farther out. So if you talk to the conservative gerontologists, mm-hmm. you hear these estimates, as I say, of an extra 7 years. That means already rather dramatic improvements in our life expectancy as we are living now. It turns out, it sounds paradoxical, and it is a rather strange statistic to take in, but if we are gaining about 2 years in life expectancy every decade, mm-hmm. which is what we've been doing now for about 160 years, life expectancy has been increasing at that rate in developed countries.
Okay.
If we continue to do that, then that is the equivalent of gaining 5 hours every day. That is, in every 24 hours that you and I live, mm-hmm. we're given the gift of another 5 years, 5 hours, sorry, somewhere down the road. It's as if we're driving down a highway at a certain rate, and the builders of the highway are way out ahead of us building
paving
on
more
highway. That's right. And so what Aubrey says, this is his metaphor of escape velocity,
yeah.
all we have to do is get those road builders building a little bit faster and maybe drive just a little bit slower. I mean, we're already getting 5 hours every 24. All we need to do is get maybe 10 hours or 15 hours, and science is going to continue to accelerate mm-hmm. in his very optimistic assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Science continues to accelerate. All the late-onset diseases that we dread become more and more manageable, and their onset is postponed farther and farther, and we achieve this escape velocity.
Voila, so that's immortality.
Yes, voila, we're there. Another reason why this argument has at least a little bit of plausibility mm-hmm. worth considering is what our life expectancy looks like when we're at our very healthiest, when we're, say, 12 years old or so. At that point, in actuarial terms, your life expectancy, if you could only hold on to the health you have then, and of course that's the if of the ages,
I
but if
so.
You could hold on to that, then you would live on average for 1,000 years, and some would live for 10,000 years. So the arch-optimists among the gerontologists, and Aubrey's the arch-arch-arch-optimist, would say, all we have to do is figure out how to maintain ourselves as well as we already have done in our lives when we were just starting out, when we were 12 or so.
We'll look at the science that might or might not make some of that possible, but there's so much envelope of history and philosophy here. I mean, humans have grappled with this for a long time, and you do as well quite wonderfully in the book, Long for This World. Give us a sense of how over time humans have thought about mortality, immortality, and the proper place of humans in that spectrum.
It's such a core, it's so deep in us, this question. It runs so deep in us that really almost the moment that people have invented writing around the world, they've been writing stories about cures for immortality, as we were saying a minute ago. And you see it again and again. That story of Gilgamesh in Babylon, in what's now Iraq, a king 4,500 years ago or so, who, according to legend, decided that all of his possessions, his empire, worthless because he was mortal. And he goes out into the desert and he finds a wizened old immortal man and begs him for the secret. And the wise old man tells him, I'll give you the secret. If you can keep your eyes open, stay awake for one solid week. And the poor king manages to keep his eyes open until the last second of the last day. And then they droop closed and he can't have the secret of eternal life. And then he begs and begs again, and the guru of immortality has pity on him and says, all right, I'll give you one more chance. If you can find this oasis and you can swim down to the bottom of the pool and find this weed and bring it back up, that will give you eternal life. And Gilgamesh, again, succeeds. He's got it. He's swimming back up. And then just as he's clambering out onto the shore, a snake, a water snake, leaps out and grabs the immortalizing herb from his hand. And again, he's lost it.
But what's the moral here, that we can't have eternal life or that we shouldn't have it?
Well, every people argues about that, and I'm sure you and I will be talking about that. Mm-hmm. Can we have it and should we have it are really two different questions. There's the feasibility question, let's say, and the desirability question. And in these ancient stories, we can almost have it. I mean, there he is. He had it in his hand, and then
so
he lost
close.
It. And Adam and Eve, the same story. And in fact, maybe even the same snake. They almost have it, and they're thrown out of the garden by God, thrown out of the Garden of Eden, because he is concerned that they're getting so smart now that they've eaten of the fruit of the tree of knowledge that they may attain immortality, the immortality that belongs properly only to those that dwell in heaven. And so they're cast out, and they can only live now for 120 years.
Only
so
120.
They're mortal.
Right. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for super longevity, and whether humans need to age. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Jonathan Wiener, professor at the Columbia School of Journalism, author of terrific new book, Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us from New York. Jonathan, we've got lots of callers. We're going to hear in a moment from a scientist right in the middle of all this. But let's go to Brewstertown, Tennessee, and Terry first. Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, and Jonathan, thanks for taking the call. I'm curious as to how many people that he interviewed that are honest and productive that are obsessed with immortality.
Why do you stipulate honest and productive people? Do you think honest and productive people wouldn't be interested, Terry?
I don't think they obsess about it.
Jonathan, you've talked to a lot of people, those who are and those who aren't obsessed. Is there a type who does?
I don't know that there is a type. It's an interesting question. I've been thinking about that. And is there an age that's more obsessed with immortality? I don't know. I talked with someone who's a polar opposite of Aubrey de Grey when I was visiting in England, a man named Martin Raff, who's a distinguished elderly biologist, interested in cell death, oddly enough, in his career,
okay.
Retired. Says that he would hate to be granted even one extra day, and yet he's had a wonderful life and he's enjoying his retirement to the hilt, but he thinks every life has its stages and phases, and he is happy to make way for the next generation. I've met many, many people who feel that way. I would say maybe it divides about 50-50. Among the scientists I've spoken with.
Is there a presumption in those who would like to live to be 150 or 200 or 500 that that's going to be a good life? I mean, life can often be painful.
That's Raff's argument. He says, look, I've been really lucky. I've been spared most of the misery, most of the ugliness that life can bring, not all of it, but most of it. And I don't want to keep rolling the dice, in effect. I would hate to have to hope for this much luck for another 60 years. But then there are the optimists, Aubrey being one of the great optimists on the planet right now, who feel that he wants as much life as he can get, and science is bringing us a golden age. He has very much a utopian view. And if there's any type, I would say, that I've run into, it's the the computer savvy, or maybe the computer engineer, the software engineer or hardware engineer, mm-hmm. those are people who have seen this computer revolution continue to accelerate and the power of computers doubling at this regular rate. And they have this enormous utopian feeling that we're hurtling toward something that some people call the singularity. It's the moment when computers and technology reach this extraordinary explosion of power in which a minor problem like mortality will be trivial to solve and everything will be good. And they want to live to that moment, that singularity. It really is has a religious apocalyptic quality, even this faith in the singularity.
Of course, Aubrey de Grey isn't talking about plopping his brain into a robot that will take it on forever. He's talking about actually humans with their bodies living a long, long time. And he's, as I read you, Jonathan, he's describing aging itself as, which we tend to accept, as kind of a disease, as a pox.
Yeah. He and many other people look at aging now increasingly as a problem to be solved. There are gerontologists who argue. I quote one of them in the book, Judy Campisi, as arguing that since we have a war on cancer and we are all at least behind that in principle, why shouldn't we try to defeat cancer, or why shouldn't we try to defeat Alzheimer's or diabetes? Why shouldn't we try to defeat aging? And since aging is the single greatest predictor, risk factor for all those diseases, aren't you all working on the same thing in biomedicine if you are trying to slow down aging or even engineer negligible rates of aging, which is Aubrey's dream? He calls it his SENSE program, Strategies for the Engineering of Negligible Senescence.
Negligible senescence. We'll hear from Judith Campisi in just a minute, but let's hear a little bit of Aubrey de Grey. Paint a picture of this guy for us. 47 years old, beard down to his waist, and he can really go on about this, Jonathan.
He's a character. As I say, I've followed this field forever, for all of my writing life, and I've never met a character quite like Aubrey. He's 6 feet tall. He's incredibly lean. He looks like a medieval saint walked right off the wall, right out of the mosaics. And he carries himself as if he really has that chance to live 1,000 years, or he's lived 1,000 already. And yet at the same time, ironically enough, he drinks beer from morning till night. So he's not obviously doing what most of us would think would help him attain that 1,000-year lifespan.
Well, he's staying lean somehow. Here's a little bit of Aubrey de Grey. This is at the TED Med Conference in 2009. Aging, he's saying here, is the cause of death for 2/3 of the world's population, 100,000 deaths a day. He says it's humanity's biggest problem.
The fact is, it's not fun. And also, hello, it's very expensive indeed to be elderly. So, I mean, put it this way, is this humanity's worst problem? You know, we've got a lot of problems, but I think there's a good case that this really is the worst one of all. 100,000 people a day is a lot of people and a lot of suffering. What else matches that?
Let's solve it, says Aubrey de Grey, as conveyed in Jonathan Weiner's new book, Long for This World. What better to solve than aging itself? He's been sort of marginalized by a lot of scientists, but not all. Judith Campisi joins us right now from Berkeley, California. She's professor at the Buck Institute for Age Research and Independent Biomedical Research Institute there, senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Judy Campisi, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
What do you make of what Jonathan describes as this new feverish state of gerontology? Is there a sense of an imminent breakthrough or an approach to one, Judy?
Well, I would say that the field has changed enormously since I've been in it, probably now maybe 15 years. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan is right. I think in the early stages of the field, people were frustrated. We really didn't know where to look. And then all of a sudden, the problem of aging became amenable to genetics and the powerful tools of molecular biology. So there is a lot of hope. I would say most of my colleagues don't see lifespan extension to 500 or 1,000 years as being feasible or even desirable. But certainly, I think the possibility of living longer, healthier lives, pushing back that terrible period of disability that many people experience at the end of their life, I think there is a lot of optimism about that.
And do you see a kind of great leap forward at some point in that, or is it just a relentless little nibbling forward in the average lifespan, Judy?
Oh, I've been in science too long to believe in great leaps forward. No. I mean, just to put this in perspective, it's now possible for scientists to take a little worm that lives 2 years, or sorry, 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and extend the lifespan of that worm tenfold. That's enormous. You go to something a little bit more complex, like a fruit fly. There, well, twofold. And then you go to something like a mouse, and I think on average mice live about 3.5 years, and I think the world record for the longest-lived mouse, engineered by scientists and kept in a little cage in a very well-lit, well-fed room, is about 5 years. So I think we're going to see incremental changes, and I don't really see that we're going to be extended in our lifespan. We're not going to see doubling of human lifespan or anything that's draconian, but we are nibbling away at it, that's for sure.
Let's get a call from Warren, New Hampshire, and Greg. Greg, you're on with Jonathan Weiner and Judy Campisi.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks, and Judy. Good stuff, but I have to look back to my youth where, as a Catholic, I was looking for reasons to believe in heaven, and I thought the best argument I'd heard was that our desire for immortality argues for the existence of heaven because if we have a desire or an appetite for something, it must exist. Hmm. And then, as I've grown into my faith, I found that this notion of immortality or perpetuity is much more of a challenge to my faith. I mean, do we truly deserve it? I think seems to me, you know, it's just a nightmare, whether it's in a blessed form or a damned form. You know, I just can't imagine being anything but terrible. You know,
because so why? Because you would be physically decrepit, or why?
Well, no. I'm probably taking the argument, the discussion in a weird direction, kind of into theology.
No, I don't think so. But how are you picturing
the notion of you know, some kind of heaven? You know, out of, let's assume that you know, my faith, as articulated by my church. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Posits, you know, we're not going to have these problems with the body. It's going to be
in a heavenly existence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but even that, you know, my brain now can't deal with the notion of any kind of ceaseless, you know, repetition. Or I just can't. It's not. I'd have to have a different brain to be able to dig it.
I love it, Greg. Thanks, Jonathan. I mean, there's the kind of, you know, make it stop argument. Ceaseless life. But on the other hand, That's immortality, the great, you know, must-have desire.
It's very strong in us, the longing for immortality and also the dread of it. And I think both go very, very deep, and there's good reason to worry about what it would be like to have too long a life, even far short of eternal life. There is a great philosopher named Bernard Williams who wrote a famous essay called The Tedium of Immortality, in which he argued that if you had an extra century to live at, say, in the body you had at 40 or 30 or 20, then you would soon, you know, after a couple centuries, mm-hmm. you would have exhausted all the possibilities for your particular personality in your particular body in the world. You just couldn't do it anymore. It would be like singing the same song over and over again.
You quote
forever.
Truman Capote saying, "Who the hell wants to live forever?"
Well,
wait.
I think it's a very personal thing. And I think that other great philosopher, J.R. Tolkien, mm-hmm. had a series of creatures. Remember those trees who lived for thousands of years?
Yes.
And they had a very different attitude towards the earth, a very different attitude towards each other because of their very, very long lifespan. I'm not sure that we can extrapolate how we would feel if we lived for very long periods of time based on the short lifespans that we have now.
Well, that's interesting, a kind of parochialism that we have now of the short-lived, you're saying.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Tom in Seattle, Washington. Tom, you're on the air. What do you think, Tom?
Well, hello.
Hello. What do you think, Tom? You want to live forever?
Actually, the prospect really appeals to me. I'm only 40 years old, but I think I have a slightly different perspective on life than a lot of other 40-year-olds.
Okay.
10 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, lymphoma, a very aggressive form of lymphoma, which I survived.
Congratulations.
The chemotherapy destroyed one of my heart valves, so I've now had open-heart surgery where they've gone in and actually repaired the existing valve.
Okay.
Came through that fantastically. And I just got to say, I love looking forward. I love seeing the change and fearing the bad things in life. They're bad. The things that happen to you can be seen as bad, but they are part of life, and you do grow, and it changes your perspective in very profound ways.
That's fascinating. You peered over the edge, Tom, maybe into, non-life, and came back with a desire for a whole lot more life. Maybe that's understandable.
Yeah, I don't live in fear now at all of anything, really. There is nothing to be afraid of. I mean, I was listening to you talking about one individual who had lived a long, successful life and avoiding the bad things. Well, that just seems like a terrible perspective to me, to be afraid to go further.
Just bring it on in a way. Judy Campisi, cancer is your focus.
Yeah.
As Jonathan says, that quickly dovetails into the whole issue of aging and life itself. Here's our caller, Tom, who licked it for at least for now, and we hope forever, and wants to go forever, maybe.
Yep. Well, calculations have been made about how much lifespan extension we might expect as a developed country if we cured cancer tomorrow, all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the calculations are we would add maybe 3 or 4 years of average life to the average person. And if we did the same thing for heart disease, that would probably add another 2 or 3 years of life. And the same thing would be true if we were able to eradicate Alzheimer's disease. And so all of these diseases are part of the aging process. And what all of biomedical research is doing is chipping away at them one at a time. And gerontologists are trying to get at the underlying mechanism. And the idea is that if we really understood that and could change that, we could change the trajectory of all of those diseases and make them either more manageable or postpone them. We don't know really at this point what's curable, including aging, by the way, and what is postponable. And that's still something that we're grappling with.
Jonathan, it sounds as though you're saying it may be time to sort of dig back into our philosophical understandings of this, given the advances that are being made, to get a grasp of what we really think about it, because we've got new choices coming at us.
Including the choice that, if you talk with a gerontologist like Judy Campisi, and then you talk with Aubrey de Grey, you're hearing a kind of convergence on this idea of curing aging, postponing or curing aging. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is astonishing in itself.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for super longevity and whether humans need to age. Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Jonathan Weiner is with us. His new book is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And Judith Campisi is with us from Berkeley, California, professor at the Buck Institute for Age Research, looking there at cancer and a lot more. It's great to have them both. Lots of comments here on Facebook, on the web. What Molly says, I have absolutely no desire to live forever. Tim says, I'm a 42-year-old cyclist and cook living in Nashville. People continually tell me I don't look in my 40s, but in my early 30s. I think it's due to my cycling and good eating habits. I totally expect to live to 120 at least. And here's Linda. She writes, my 89-year-old mom's goal is to live young while she's alive and die quickly when it's time. She's against immortality because she says the world is already overpopulated. Let's go to Patrick in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just recently lost my father just
Sorry.
A couple months ago.
Sorry.
And I've been thinking about this quite a bit. And as painful as his loss is, at some point, eventually, the next generation needs to pass on. And, I miss him every day, but the thought of him, living for hundreds of years longer, with me and then, my children and my children's children,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that we can become our own people. And I think, too, our mortality is maybe what makes us special. Richard Dawkins said, we are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones. The fact that we even exist is, such a chance. And the shortness of the time that we have to live our lives, I think, really can be a great motivating factor.
Motivating to what? Make the most of it.
To make the most of it, to do what you can with your life, to establish great friendships or relationships, to create great works of art. And I'm not sure if that would be possible if, Mozart was coexisting with Schubert and Keats and, Wittgenstein and, and they were all living right now. I don't know if we could move forward as a culture, as people, I'm not sure that would be possible.
It's fascinating. Their sort of meditation with the loss of your father, and we're sorry for that, but we appreciate your thoughts. Jonathan, what about it? What does your Aubrey de Grey think? I mean, here's our caller Patrick saying, do we lose the fierce urgency of now if everybody's got immortality or a very long life? How does de Grey look at how, for example, generations would interact in that kind of scenario?
I wrestle with these questions in the last third of the book, mm-hmm. and they're enormous questions. I mean, they're the largest questions that confront us, and I put Aubrey a little bit off stage in that last part of the book because his answers to these questions is brusque. He mm-hmm. says, "So there'd be very few children in the world." Very rapidly, there'd be no one under 50.
Why?
People wouldn't want to have children. He thinks he himself has no interest in having children. He has none. He's never wanted to have kids. He thinks as people live longer now, they tend to have smaller families. And if you extrapolate from that, we might postpone having children for decades, centuries, thousands of years.
Because if you're living so long, what's the rush?
Yes, that's his argument. I think you can make many, many counterarguments, but in a word, his view is, I think he might have said this at that TED conference mm-hmm. that you played a clip from,
mm-hmm.
We have a right to be our own next generation if we so choose.
Wow.
That's his point of view.
Talk about the me generation.
That's right.
That's got in it.
Me generation.
For a long, long time. Statesboro, Georgia. Stephen, you're on the air, Stephen.
Hi.
Hi.
I work in an ICU at the local hospital, and I see a lot of death and, aging and, mm-hmm. all the problems that entails on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I find interesting about the whole question is that the desire to live is always contingent upon the existential state of being. I've never met anyone who didn't want to live, even immortality, if life were a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very interesting because, we have people that are signing DNR, do not resuscitate forms, and it's not that they want to die. It is that if life could be a certain way, they would certainly want to live. And that that observation is, you know, I've noticed that in literature, a lot of authors have written about a state of immortality that is not desirable. Kind of C.S. Lewis wrote a dystopian book about, called That Hideous Strength, about science sort of taking humanity on out in immortality, and it seems a rather hellish thing rather than bliss. And so I guess I just wanted to point out that question of immortality is always contingent upon the spiritual state of a person, or how life could be, not how life actually is. And you know, I'm a person of science because I'm in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I see that it cannot fulfill. I don't believe it can fulfill that promise of immortality, and I think it would never achieve that.
That's a great report, right from the front lines, there, Stephen. I appreciate your thoughtful view in the ICU. What great company to have there. Judy Campisi, I mean, this comes right into your wheelhouse, sort of. That's where you're doing the research, sort of battling to keep people not just alive, but in a healthy state longer and longer. You know, Stephen sees that.
I think it's important to distinguish death from aging. And I realize it's almost impossible to think about one without the other, but mm-hmm. modern biomedical endeavors in aging research are really focused on aging, not on death. So what we want to do is understand why things fall apart the way they do, why the organism is set up to be vulnerable to all these diseases that will eventually end our lives. But death is something quite different. It really, I mean, you can step off the curb and be hit by a car and, mm-hmm. and you're dead. This is also something that Aubrey talked about a little bit, and Jonathan alludes to in his book about Aubrey's idea as well. Eventually we'll learn how to put all the pieces back together again, just like Humpty Dumpty, and we won't even have to worry about catastrophic death. But they're two really quite distinct things, and I think that within the realm of science today, understanding aging and perhaps postponing it or slowing it down is something that is doable, or at least we think it's doable. We're still not sure. As far as death is concerned, that really is where it gets into the realm of the metaphysical, and scientists don't really have much to say about that, actually.
Well, no, except over the years, a lot of people have thought about it. I mean, Jonathan, you know, you've got Capote again saying, after all, there's such a thing as life saturation, the point when everything is pure effort and total repetition. You know, our caller Stephen, who watches this, says, you know, refers to C.S. Lewis and describing immortality as a kind of hellish state. Are there cultural differences here, Western, Eastern? I don't know, Jonathan.
There do seem to be some cultural differences. The greatest history of thinking about life extension was written by a historian of science named Gerald Grumman, and he divides thinking on this subject into the pro-longevist camp, those who want to extend life, and the apologists, those who want to apologize for the way things are and accept mortality and accept death. He says that in the West, we're much more inclined to feel guilty about the longing to live forever or live long, long, long lives. In the East, traditionally, there's more there's less stigma attached to that longing.
And does that? But a lot of the research is being done here is in the West today, I guess. Judy says, you know, scientists don't really think about the death part. They think about better quality of life while it's there. But maybe that converges on that line that defines the difference between life and death anyway.
It gets mind split, you know, brain splitting. How do you put all this together? Because if you're thinking about chipping away at the problem of mortality one disease at a time, as Judy was saying mm-hmm. earlier, and you're thinking about getting at the root causes of these late-onset diseases through preventing whatever gunk it is that's building up in our cells over the decades of our lives, preventing that, the ultimate preventive medicine, preventing all the late onset diseases and preventing, in effect, aging, then you're also fighting, you're fighting aging, but you're also fighting death. And so you do get into this very strange, difficult metaphysical terrain. I don't think we understand it at all. I don't think we understand it ourselves. And this science forces us toward those questions.
Judy?
I guess I agree with Jonathan. It is a fine line. I think scientists try not to think about the metaphysical because we don't understand it. We can't control it. Mm. But I agree. When you think about it, it is difficult. It would be difficult for me to say, honestly, I'm not working on death in some remote way. But I don't think about that on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Charlottesville, Virginia, and Fergus. Fergus, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make two comments.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is really that as an conformist to the ideals of evolution, I think that any notions of immortality would be threatened by the evolution of disease and bacteria. I think that in trying to become immortal, what we're really doing is constantly battling the evolution of disease. And then from a sociological standpoint, I also wanted to say that it seems that our interest in immortality is really a result of a post-Enlightenment desire to see what our newfound awareness of our impact on the environment will be in future generations. When you look at old societies, you know, the Celts, bards, for example, mm-hmm. continued the knowledge of their people on for generations orally. And I think that we're in a place now where science and technology is allowing us to really see in a fast-track kind of way what our impact would be in the future. And I think that that's what our desire is coming from. I don't think that it's possible when you consider the evolution of disease.
A very interesting perspective. Yeah, thanks, Fergus. We want to stick around to see what's coming if we believe in progress, I guess. And this idea also, Jonathan, that, you know, disease has a vote here, too. It's not just human longevity or prospering. Disease and bacteria has an evolutionary urge, I guess, to do the same, Jonathan.
Yes, and even bacteria age, it turns out. We're all in the same boat together. I think there's a lot to that. That dream of the Enlightenment, which goes back to some of the United States founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, who was a great scientist and of course, one of the great pillars of the very start of our republic, really wanted to see the outcome of both the American experiment and the scientific experiment. And he predicted that science would eventually reach the point at which we could cure aging. And even little inventions like his own Franklin stove or the bifocals, all of those he thought of as small steps toward the great goal of a cure for aging.
Wanted to be embalmed in Madeira wine, so maybe he'd have a chance to come back and see that?
Exactly. And that was all entwined for him, the glorious future of the United States and the glorious future of science and almost infinite extension of human life. Maybe we would learn how to build flying machines, he said, and maybe we would learn how to live forever.
Let's get one more call. Wendy in Wayland, Massachusetts. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Judy and Jonathan. I'm calling because I'm very interested in this. My two daughters have mitochondrial disease, and therefore I'm very interested in mitochondrial research. And I know that mitochondrial research is very central to aging as well, and also to diabetes and cancer and obesity. I wanted to ask, in particular, Judy and Jonathan, what do you know about the research that's going on in terms of mitochondrial research, and how is that helping us understand these diseases?
Let us pick it up, Wendy. Our time is short. Judy, what do you say on this front? Absolutely key science when it comes to aging and health.
It is, and we're learning a lot every day. And actually, there's more hope for understanding mitochondria than it is for understanding the rest of the cell because they're so tiny and their genome is so small. And I think that's one of the areas that is going to have a bigger impact sooner rather than later. is understanding mitochondria and being able to control them a little bit when they go awry.
So hope there. Wendy, thanks for your call. Jonathan, you quote the Chinese sage Li Ho right early in the book saying, if heaven too had passions, even heaven would grow old. What's your sense after having looked into this so much? You know, can we have our human passions and have them, what, infinitely, eternally?
Having spent some years now on this subject, I find, strangely enough, that my own sense of mortality rather than immortality has been enhanced. And I feel as if that's a good thing. I feel as if the passions of human life include this sense of mortality at their deepest. And I think that is what makes life so rich for us.
Jonathan Weiner's new book is Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. If the science you write about here continues to advance, whatever we think of life, we may have a whole lot more of it. Jonathan, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
And Judith Campisi at the Buck Institute for Age Research in Berkeley. Judith, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for your thoughts. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.